Saturday, Disc 6.
He pushes the door open and goes through. She is right in front of him, sitting on a wooden chair at a round table covered with a chenille cloth. There's a window at her back, and beyond it, a window of the house next door, 10 feet away. There are other women ranged around the edges of the room, sitting in high-backed chairs with curved wooden arms. Some are watching or looking in the direction of the television mounted on the wall, out of reach. Others are staring at the floor. They stir or seem to sway as he enters, as if gently buffeted by the air the door displaces. There's a general cheery response to his, "Good afternoon, ladies," and they watch him with interest. At this stage, they can't be sure he isn't one of their own close relatives. To his right, in the farthest of the connecting sitting rooms, is Annie, a woman with wild grey hair which radiates from her head in fluffy spokes. She's shuffling unsupported towards him at speed. When she reaches the end of the third sitting room, she'll turn back and keep moving back and forwards all day until she's guided towards a meal or bed. His mother is watching him closely, pleased and anxious all at once. She thinks she knows his face. He might be the doctor or the odd job man. She's waiting for a cue. He kneels by her chair and takes her hand, which is smooth and dry and very light. "Hello, Mum. Lily. It's Henry. Your son, Henry."
"Hello, darling. Where are you going?"
"I've come to see you. We'll go and sit in your room."
"I'm sorry, dear. I don't have a room. I'm waiting to go home. I'm getting the bus."
It pains him whenever she says that, even though he knows she's referring to her childhood home where she thinks her mother is waiting for her. He kisses her cheek and helps her out of her chair, feeling the tremors of effort or nervousness in her arms. As always, in the first dismaying moments of seeing her again, his eyes prick. She protests feebly,
"I don't know where we can go."
He dislikes speaking with the forced cheerfulness nurses use on the wards, even on adult patients with no mental impairment.
"Just pop this in your mouth for me."
But he does it anyway, partly to disguise his feelings.
"You've got a lovely little room. As soon as you see it, you'll remember. This way now."
Arm in arm, they walk slowly through the other sitting rooms, standing aside to let Annie pass. It's reassuring that Lily is decently dressed. The helpers knew he was coming. She wears a deep red skirt with a matching brushed cotton blouse, black tights and black leather shoes. She's always dressed well. Hers must have been the last generation to care, as a matter of course, about hats. There used to be dark rows of them, almost identical, on the top shelf of her wardrobe, cocooned in a whiff of mothball. When they step out into a corridor, she turns away to her left, and he has to put his hand on her narrow shoulder to guide her back. "Here it is. Do you recognize your door?"
"I've never been out this way before."
He opens her door and hands her in. The room is about 8 feet by 10, with a glazed door giving onto a small back garden. The single bed is covered by a floral eiderdown and various soft toys that were part of her life long before her illness. Some of her remaining ornaments, a robin on a log, 2 comically exaggerated glass squirrels are in a glazed corner cupboard. Others are ranged about a sideboard close to the door. On the wall near the hand basin is a framed photograph of Lily and Jack, Henry's father, standing on a lawn. Just in shot is the handle of a pram, presumably in which lies the oblivious Henry. She's pretty in a white summer dress and has her head cocked in that shy, quizzical way he remembers well. The young man is smoking a cigarette and wears a blazer and open-necked white shirt. He's tall, with a stoop, and has big hands like his son. His grin is wide and untroubled.
It's always useful to have solid proof that the old have had their go at being young. But there is also an element of derision in photography. The couple appear vulnerable, easily mocked for appearing not to know that their youth is merely an episode, or that the tasty smouldering item in Jack's right hand will contribute, Henry's theory, later that same year to his sudden death. Having failed to remember its existence, Lily isn't surprised to find herself in her room. She instantly forgets that she didn't know about it. However, she dithers, uncertain of where she should sit. Henry shows her into a high-backed chair by the French window and sits facing her on the edge of the bed. It's ferociously hot, even hotter than his own bedroom. Perhaps his blood is still stirred by the game and the hot shower and the warmth of the car. He'd be content to stretch out on the oversprung bed and start to think about the day and perhaps doze a little. How interesting his life suddenly appears from the confines of this room. At that moment, with the eiderdown beneath him and the heat, he feels a heaviness in his eyes and can't stop them closing. And his visit has hardly begun. To revive himself, he pulls off his sweater. Then he shows Lily the plant he has brought.
"Look," he says, "it's an orchid for your room."
As he holds it out towards her and the frail white flower bobs between them, she recoils.
"Why have you got that?"
"It's yours. It'll keep flowering through the winter. Isn't it pretty? It's for you."
"It's not mine," Lily says firmly. "I've never seen it before."
He had the same baffling conversation last time. The disease proceeds by tiny, unnoticed strokes in small blood vessels in the brain. Cumulatively, the infarcts cause cognitive decline by disrupting the neural nets. She unravels in little steps. Now she's lost her grasp of the concept of a gift, and with it the pleasure. Adopting again the tone of the cheerful nurse, he says,
"I'll put it up here where you can see it."
She's about to protest, but her attention wanders. She has seen some decorative china pieces on a display shelf above her bed, right behind her son. Her mood is suddenly conciliatory.
"I've got plenty of them cups and saucers, so I can always go out with one of them. But the thing is, the space between people is so tiny."
She brings up two wavering hands to show him a gap.
"That there's hardly enough space to squeeze through. There's too much binding."
"I agree," Henry says as he settles back on the bed. "There's far too much binding."
Damage from the small vessel clotting tends to accumulate in the white matter and destroy the mind's connectivity. Along the way, well before the process is complete, Lily is able to deliver her rambling treatises, her nonsense monologues with touching seriousness. She doesn't doubt herself at all, nor does she think that he's unable to follow her. The structure of her sentences is intact, and the moods which inflect her various descriptions make sense. It pleases her if he nods and smiles and chimes in from time to time. She isn't looking at him as she gathers her thoughts, but past him, concentrating on an elusive matter, staring as though through a window at an unbounded view. She goes to speak, but remains silent. Her pale green eyes, sunk deep in bowls of finely folded light brown skin, have a flat, dulled quality, like dusty stones under glass. They give an accurate impression of understanding nothing. He can't bring her news of the family. The mention of strange names, any names, can alarm her. So although she won't understand, he often talks to her about work. What she warms to is the sound, the emotional tone of a friendly conversation. He is about to describe to her the Chapman girl and how well she's come through when Lily suddenly speaks up. Her mood is anxious, even a little querulous.
"And you know that this... You know, Auntie, what people put on their shoes to make them... You know..."
shoe polish.
He never understands why she calls him auntie or which of her many aunts is haunting her.
No, no, they put it all over their shoes and rub it with a cloth. Well, anyway, it's a bit like shoe polish. It's that sort of thing. We had side plates and God knows what all along the street. We had everything but the right thing because we were in the wrong place.
Then she suddenly laughs. It's become clearer to her.
If you turn the picture round and take the back off like I did, you get such a lot of pleasure out of it. It's all what it meant. And the laugh we had out of it.
And she laughs gaily, just like she used to. And he laughs too. It's all what it meant. Now she's away, describing what might be a disintegrated memory of a street party and a little watercolour she once bought in a jumble sale. Sometime later, when Jenny arrives with the refreshments, Lily stares at her without recognition. Perrone stands and clears space on a low table. He notices the suspicion Lily is showing towards what she takes to be a complete stranger. And so, as soon as Jenny leaves and before Lily can speak, he says, "What a lovely girl she is. Always helpful."
"She's marvellous,"
Lily agrees. The memory of whoever was in the room is already fading. His emotional cue is irresistible and she immediately smiles and begins to elaborate while he spoons all 6 tea bags out of the metal pot.
"She always comes running, even if it's narrow all the way down. She wants to come on one of them long things, but she doesn't have the fare. I sent her the money, but she doesn't have it in her hand. She wants some music, and I said you might as well make up a little band and play it yourself. I worry about her, though. I said to her, 'Why do you put all the slices in one bowl when no one's standing up? You can't do it yourself.'"
He knows who she's talking about and waits for more. Then he says, "You shall go and see her." It's a long time since he last tried to explain to her that her mother died in 1970. It is easier now to support the delusion and keep the conversation moving along. Everything belongs in the present. His immediate concern is to prevent her eating a tea bag the way she almost did last time. He piles them onto a saucer which he places on the floor by his foot. He puts a half-filled cup within her reach and offers her a biscuit and a napkin. She spreads it over her lap and carefully places the biscuit in its centre. She raises the cup to her lips and drinks. At moments like these, when she's skillful in the long-established routines and looks demure in her colour-matched clothes, a perfectly well-looking 77-year-old with amazing legs for her age, athlete's legs, he can imagine that it's all been a mistake, a bad dream, and that she'll leave her tiny room and come away with him into the heart of the city and eat fish stew with her daughter-in-law and grandchildren and stay a while. Lily says,
"I was there last week, Auntie, on the bus, and my mum was in the garden. I said to her, 'You can walk down there, see what you're going to get, and the next thing is the balancing of everything you've got.' She's not well. Her feet. I'll go there in a minute, and I can't help losing her a jersey."
How strange it would have been for Lily's mother, an aloof, unmaternal woman, to have known that the little girl at her skirts would one day, in a remote future, a science fiction date in the next century, talk of her all the time and long to be home with her. Would that have softened her? Now Lily is set. She'll talk on for as long as he sits there. It's hard to tell if she's actually happy. Sometimes she laughs, at others she describes shadowy disputes and grievances, and her voice becomes indignant. In many of the situations she conjures, she's remonstrating with a man who won't see sense.
"I told him anything that's going for a liberty, and he said, 'I don't care.' 'You can give it away,' and I said, 'Don't let it waste in the fire.' And all the new stuff that's going to be picked up." If she becomes too agitated by the story she's telling, Henry will cut in and laugh loudly and say, "Mum, that's really very funny." Being suggestible, she'll laugh too, and her mood will shift, and the story she tells then will be happier. For now, she's in neutral mode. There's a clock, and a jersey again, and again, a space too narrow to pass through. And Henry, sipping the thick brown tea, half listening, half asleep in the small room's airless warmth, thinks how in 35 years or less it could be him, stripped of everything he does and owns, a shrivelled figure meandering in front of Theo or Daisy while they wait to leave and return to a life of which he'll have no comprehension. High blood pressure is one good predictor of strokes. 122/65 last time. The systolic could be lower. Total cholesterol? 5.2. Not good enough. Elevated levels of lipoprotein A are said to have a robust association with multi-infarct dementia. He'll eat no more eggs and have only semi-skimmed milk in his coffee, and coffee too will have to go one day. He isn't ready to die, and nor is he ready to half-die. He wants his prodigiously connected myelin-rich white matter intact, like an unsullied snowfield. No cheese, then. He'll be ruthless with himself in his pursuit of boundless health to avoid his mother's fate. Mental death.
"I put sap in the clock," she's telling him, "to make it moist."
An hour passes, and then he forces himself fully awake and stands up, too quickly perhaps, because he feels a sudden dizziness. Not a good sign. He extends both hands towards her, feeling immense and unstable as he looms over her tiny form. "Come on now, Mum," he says gently. "It's time for me to go, and I'd like you to see me to the door." Childlike in her obedience, she takes his hands and he helps her from her chair. He piles up the tray and puts it outside the room, then remembers the tea bags, half concealed under the bed, and puts them out too. She might have feasted on them. He guides her into the corridor, reassuring her all the while, aware that she's stepping into an alien world. She has no idea which way to turn as they leave her room. She doesn't comment on the unfamiliar surroundings, but she grips his hand tighter. In the first of the sitting rooms, two women, one with snowy hair and braids, the other completely bald, are watching television with the sound off. Approaching from the middle room is Cyril, as always in cravat and sports jacket, and today carrying a cane and wearing a deerstalker. He's the home's resident gent, sweet-mannered, marooned in one particular well-defined fantasy. He believes he owns a large estate and is obliged to go around visiting his tenants and be scrupulously polite. Perrone has never seen him unhappy. Cyril raises his hat at Lily and calls, "Good morning, my dear. Everything well? Any complaints?" Her face tightens and she looks away. On the screen above her head, Perrone sees the march, Hyde Park still, a vast crowd before a temporary stage, and in the far distance a tiny figure at a microphone, then the aerial shot of the same, and then the marchers in columns with their banners, still arriving through the park gates. He and Lily stop to let Cyril pass. There's a shot of the newsreader at her space-age desk, then the plane, as he saw it in the early hours, the blackened fuselage vivid in a lake of foam, like a tasteless ornament on an iced cake. Now Paddington Police Station, said to be secure against terrorist attack. A reporter is standing outside speaking into a microphone. There's a development. Are the Russian pilots really radical Muslims? Perrone is reaching up for the volume control, but Lily is suddenly agitated and trying to tell him something important.
"If it gets too dry, it will curl up again. I told him, and I told him you have to water it, but he wouldn't put it down."
It's all right, he tells her. He will put it down. I'll tell him to. I promise you. He decides against the television, and they come away.
He needs to concentrate on his leave-taking, for he knows that she'll think she's coming with him. He'll be standing once more at the front door with his meaningless explanation that he'll return soon. Jenny or one of the other girls will have to distract her as he steps outside. Together they walk back through the first sitting room. Tea and crustless sandwiches are being served to the ladies at the round table with the chenille cloth. He calls a greeting to them, but they seem too distracted to reply. Lily is happier now and leans her head against his arm. As they come into the hall, they see Jenny Lavin by the door, already raising her hand to the high double security lock and smiling in their direction. Just then his mother pats his hand with a feathery touch and says,
"Out here, it only looks like a garden, Auntie. But it's the countryside, really, and you can go for miles. When you walk here, you feel lifted up, right high across the counter. I can't manage all them plates without a brush, but God will take care of you and see what you're going to get because it's a swimming race. You'll squeeze through somehow."
It is a slow haul back into central London, more than an hour to reach Westbourne Grove from Perivale. Dense traffic is heading into the city for Saturday night pleasures just as the first wave of coaches is bringing the marchers out. During the long crawl towards the lights at Gypsy Corner, he lowers his window to taste the scene in full. The bovine patience of a jam, the abrasive tang of icy fumes, the thunderous, idling machinery in six lanes east and west, the yellow streetlight bleaching colour from the bodywork, the jaunty thud of entertainment systems and red tail lights stretching way ahead into the city, white headlights pouring out of it. He tries to see it or feel it in historical terms, this moment in the last decades of the petroleum age, when a 19th century device is brought to final perfection in the early years of the 21st. When the unprecedented wealth of masses at serious play in the unforgiving modern city makes for a sight that no previous age can have imagined. Ordinary people. Rivers of light. He wants to make himself see it as Newton might, or his contemporaries Boyle, Hooke, Wren, Willis. Those clever, curious men of the English Enlightenment who for a few years held in their minds nearly all the world's science. Surely they would be awed. Mentally, he shows it off to them. This is what we've done. This is commonplace in our time. All this teeming illumination would be wondrous if he could only see it through their eyes. But he can't quite trick himself into it. He can't feel his way past the iron weight of the actual to see beyond the boredom of a traffic tailback or the delay to which he himself is contributing, or the drab commercial hopes of a parade of shops he's been stuck beside for 15 minutes. He doesn't have the lyric gift to see beyond it. He's a realist and can never escape. But then, perhaps two poets in the family are enough. Beyond Acton, the traffic eases. In the late afternoon dusk, a single slab of red in the western sky, almost rectangular, an emblem of the natural world, of wilderness somewhere out of sight, fades slowly as it pursues him in his rear-view mirror. Even if the westbound lanes out of the city were free, he's glad not to be heading that way. He wants to get home and collect himself before he starts cooking. He needs to check that there's champagne in the fridge and bring some red wine into the kitchen to warm. The cheese, too, needs to be softened in the centrally heated air. He needs to lie down for 10 minutes. He's certainly in no mood for Theo's amplified blues. But this is parenthood, as fixed as destiny, and at last he's parking in the street off Westbourne Grove, a couple of hundred yards from the old music hall theatre. He's 45 minutes late. When he reaches it, the building is silent and in darkness, and the doors are closed. but they open easily when he pushes against them so that he stumbles as he enters the foyer. He waits to let his eyes adjust to the low light, straining to hear sounds, aware of the familiar smell of dusty carpeting. Is he too late? It would almost be a relief. He moves deeper into the lobby past what he thinks must be the ticket office until he comes to another set of double doors. He gropes for a metal bar, pushes down, and enters. 100 feet away, the stage is in soft bluish light broken by pinpricks of red on the amplifier racks. By the drums, the hi-hat catches the light and projects an elongated purple disc across the floor of the theatre, which is without seats. There's no other light apart from an orange exit sign beyond the stage. People are moving and crouching by the equipment and stirring beside the gleam of a keyboard. Just discernible above the low fuzzy hum of the speaker banks is a murmur of voices. A silhouetted figure stands at the front of the stage, adjusting the heights of two microphones. Perrone moves to his right, and in total darkness follows the wall with his hand until he's facing the centre of the stage. A second person appears by the microphones, carrying a saxophone, whose intricate outline is sharply defined against the blue. In response to a call, the keyboard sounds a single note, and a bass guitar tunes its top string to it. Another guitar plays a broken open chord, all in tune, then a third does the same. The drummer sits in and moves his cymbals closer and fiddles with the pedal on a bass drum. The murmur of voices ceases, and the roadies disappear into the wings. Theo and Chaz are at the front of the stage by the microphones looking out across the auditorium. It's only at this point that Perrone realizes they've seen him come in and that they've been waiting. Theo's guitar starts out alone with a languorous two-bar turnaround, a simple descending line from the fifth fret tumbling into a thick chord which oozes into a second and remains hanging there, an unresolved fading seventh. Then, with a sharp kick and roll on the tom, and five stealthy rising notes from the bass, the blues begins. It's a downbeat, Stormy Monday kind of song, but the chords are dense and owe more to jazz. The stage light is shifting to white. Theo, motionless in his usual trance, goes 3 times round the 12 bars. It's a smooth, rounded tone, plenty of feedback to mould the notes into their wailing lament, with a little sting in the attack on the shorter runs. The piano and rhythm guitar lay down their thick, jazzy chords. Henry feels the bass line thump into his sternum and puts his hand to the sore spot there. It's building into a big sound, and he's uncomfortable, and resists it. In his present state, he'd prefer to be at home with a Mozart trio on the hi-fi and a glass of icy white wine. But he doesn't hold out for long. Something is swelling or lightening in him as Theo's notes rise, and on the second turnaround lift into a higher register and begin to soar. This is what the boys have been working on, and they want him to hear it, and he's touched. He's catching on to the idea, to the momentum of their exuberance and expertise. At the same time, he discovers that the song is not in the usual pattern of a 12-bar blues. There's a middle section with an unworldly melody that rises and falls in semitones. Chaz leans into his microphone to sing with Theo in a close, strange harmony. "Baby, you can choose despair, or you can be happy if you dare. So let me take you there, my city square, city square." Then Chaz, with all his fresh tricks from New York, turns aside, lifts his sax and comes in on a wild and ragged high note, like a voice cracking with joy that holds and holds, then tapers and drops away in a downward spiral, echoing Theo's intro, and delivers the band back into the 12-bar round. Chaz, too, goes 3 times round. The sax is edgy, with choppy rhythms and notes held against the chord changes, then released in savage runs. Theo and the bass guitarist are playing in octaves a tricksy repeated figure that shifts in unexpected ways and never quite returns to its starting point. This is a blues at walking speed, but a driving rhythm is building up. On Chas's third turnaround, the two boys come back to the mics, back to the lilting refrain whose harmonies are so close, they're discords. Is Theo paying tribute to his teacher, to Jack Bruce of Cream? So let me take you there, City Square, City Square. Then it's the keyboards break, and the others join in the difficult circular riff. No longer tired, Henry comes away from the wall where he's been leaning and walks into the middle of the dark auditorium, towards the great engine of sound. He lets it engulf him. There are these rare moments where musicians together touch something sweeter than they've ever found before in rehearsals or performance, beyond the merely collaborative or technically proficient, when their expression becomes as easy and graceful as friendship or love. This is when they give us a glimpse of what we might be, of our best selves, and of an impossible world in which you give everything you have to others but lose nothing of yourself. Out in the real world, there exist detailed plans, visionary projects for peaceable realms, all conflicts resolved, happiness for everyone, forever. Mirages for which people are prepared to die and kill. Christ's kingdom on earth, the workers' paradise, the ideal Islamic state. But only in music and only on rare occasions does the curtain actually lift on this dream of community, and it's tantalizingly conjured before fading away with the last notes. Naturally, no one can ever agree when it's happening. Henry last heard it for himself at the Wigmore Hall, a utopian community briefly realized in the Schubert Octet, when the wind players, with little, leaning, shrugging movements of their bodies, wafted their notes across the stage at the string section, who sent them back, sweetened. He also heard it long ago at Daisy and Theo's school, when a discordantly wailing school orchestra with a staff and pupil choir attempted Purcell and made with cracked notes an innocent and blissful concord of adults and children. And here it is now, a coherent world, everything fitting at last. He stands swaying in the dark, staring up at the stage, his right hand in his pocket gripping his keys. Theo and Chas drift back to center stage to sing their unearthly chorus. "Or you can be happy if you dare." He knows what his mother meant. He can go for miles. He feels lifted up, right high across the counter. He doesn't want the song to end. Chapter 4. He doesn't bother to park in the Mews. Instead, he pulls up right outside his front door. It's legal at this time of evening to be on a yellow line, and he's impatient to be indoors. But he takes a few seconds to examine the damage to the passenger door. Barely a mark. As he looks up from the car, he notices that the house is in darkness. Naturally, Theo is still at rehearsal. Rosalind will be picking her way through the last fine points of her court application. A few widely separated flakes of snow picked up by streetlights show up vividly against the window's glossy black. His father-in-law and daughter are due, and he's pressed for time. As he opens the door, he's trying to remember the exact phrasing of a remark Theo made earlier in the day that didn't trouble him at the time. It nags at him briefly now, but the half-hearted effort of recall itself fades as he steps into the warmth of the hall and turns on the lights. A mere light bulb can explode a thought. He goes straight down to the wine racks and takes out four bottles. His kind of fish stew needs a robust country wine, red, not white. Grammaticus introduced him to a Totavel Côte de Roussillon village, and Henry has made it his house wine. Delicious, and less than £50 a case. Uncorking wine hours before they're drunk is a form of magical thinking. The surface area exposed to the air is minute and can't possibly make a detectable difference. However, he does want the bottles warmer, and he carries them into the kitchen and puts them by the stove. Three bottles of champagne are already in the fridge. He takes a step towards the CD player, then changes his mind, for he's feeling the pull, like gravity, of the approaching TV news. It's a condition of the times, this compulsion to hear how it stands with the world and be joined to the generality, to a community of anxiety. The habit's grown stronger these past 2 years. A different scale of news value has been set by monstrous and spectacular scenes. The possibility of their recurrence is one thread that binds the days. The government's counsel that an attack in a European or American city is an inevitability isn't only a disclaimer of responsibility, it's a heady promise. Everyone fears it, but there's also a darker longing in the collective mind, a sickening for self-punishment and a blasphemous curiosity. Just as the hospitals have their crisis plans, so the television networks stand ready to deliver, and their audiences wait. Bigger, grosser next time. Please don't let it happen. But let me see it all the same, as it's happening, and from every angle, and let me be among the first to know. Also, Henry needs to hear about the pilots in custody. With the idea of the news, inseparable from it, at least at weekends, is the lustrous prospect of a glass of red wine. He empties the last of a Côte du Rhône into a glass, puts the TV on mute, and sets about stripping and chopping three onions. Impatient of the papery outer layers, he makes a deep incision, forcing his thumb in four layers deep and ripping them away, wasting a third of the flesh. He chops the remainder rapidly and tips it into a casserole with a lot of olive oil. What he likes about cooking is its relative imprecision and lack of discipline, a release from the demands of the theatre. In the kitchen, the consequences of failure are mild. Disappointment, a wisp of disgrace rarely voiced. No one actually dies. He strips and chops eight fat cloves of garlic and adds them to the onions. From recipes, he draws only the broadest principles. The cookery writers he admires speak of handfuls and a sprinkling, of chucking in this or that. They list alternative ingredients and encourage experimentation. Henry accepts that he'll never make a decent cook, that he belongs to what Rosalind calls the hearty school. Into his palm he empties several dried red chilies from a pot and crushes them between his hands and lets the flakes fall with their seeds into the onions and garlic. The TV news comes up, but he doesn't touch the mute. It's the same helicopter shot from before it got dark, the same crowd still filing into the park, the same general celebration. Onto the softened onions and garlic, pinches of saffron, some bay leaves, orange peel gratings, oregano, five anchovy fillets, two tins of peeled tomatoes. On the big Hyde Park stage, soundbite extracts of speeches by a venerable politician of the left, a pop star, a playwright, a trade unionist. Into a stockpot, he eases the skeletons of three skates. Their heads are intact, their lips girlishly full. Their eyes go cloudy on contact with the boiling water. A senior police officer is answering questions about the march. By his tight smile and the tilt of his head, he appears satisfied with the day. From the green string bag of mussels, Henry takes a dozen or so and drops them in with the skate. If they're alive and in pain, he isn't to know. Now, that same earnest reporter, silently mouthing all there is to know about the unprecedented gathering. The juice of the tomatoes is simmering with the onions and the rest, and turning reddish-orange with the saffron. Perrone, his hearing not yet fully recovered from the rehearsal, his feelings dimmed, even numbed by his visit to his mother, decides he needs to be listening to something punchy, to Steve Earle, the thinking man's Bruce Springsteen, according to Theo. But the record he wants, El Corazon, is upstairs, so he drinks the wine instead, and keeps glancing towards the set, waiting for his story. The Prime Minister is giving his Glasgow speech. Perrone touches the control in time to hear him say that the number of marches today has been exceeded by the number of deaths caused by Saddam. A clever point, the only case to make, but it should have been made from the start. Too late now. After Blix, it looks tactical. Henry turns the sound off. It occurs to him how content he is to be cooking. Even self-consciousness doesn't diminish the feeling. Into the biggest colander, he pours the rest of the mussels and scrubs them with a vegetable brush at the sink under running water. The pale greenish clams, on the other hand, look dainty and pure, and he merely rinses them. One of the skates has arched its spine as if to escape the boiling. As he pushes it back down with a wooden spatula, the vertebral column breaks, right below T3. Last summer, he operated on a teenage girl who broke her back at C5 and T2, falling out of a tree at a pop festival trying to get a better view of Radiohead. She'd just finished school and wanted to study Russian at Leeds. Now, after 8 months' rehab, she's doing fine. But he dismisses the memory. He isn't thinking about work, he wants to cook. From the fridge, he takes a quarter-full bottle of white wine, a Sancerre, and tips it over the tomato mix. On a broader, thicker chopping block, Perrone arranges the monkfish tails and cuts them into chunks and tips them into a big white bowl. Then he washes the ice off the tiger prawns and puts them in too. In a second bowl, he puts the clams and mussels. Both bowls go into the fridge with dinner plates as lids. An establishing shot shows the United Nations building in New York, and next, Colin Powell getting into a black limousine. It's demotion for Henry's story, but he doesn't mind. He's cleaning up the kitchen, wiping his mess from the central island into a large bin and scrubbing the chopping boards under running water. Then it's time to tip the boiling juice off the skates and mussels into the casserole. When that's done, he has now, he reckons, about 2.5 litres of bright orange stock, which he'll cook for another 5 minutes. Just before dinner, he'll reheat it and simmer the clams, monkfish, mussels and prawns in it for 10 minutes. They'll eat the stew with brown bread, salad and red wine. After New York, there's the Kuwait-Iraq border, and military trucks moving in convoy along a desert road, and our lads kipping down by the tracks of their tanks, then eating bangers next morning from their mess tins. He takes 2 bags of mash from the bottom of the fridge and empties them into a salad tosser. He runs the cold tap over the leaves. An officer, barely in his 20s, is standing outside his tent pointing with a stick at a map on an easel. Perrone isn't tempted to disable the mute. These items from the front have a cheerful, censored air that lowers his spirits. He spins the salad and tips it into a bowl. Oil, lemon, pepper and salt he'll throw on later. There's cheese and fruit for pudding. Theo and Daisy can set the table. His preparations are done just as the burning plane story comes up, fourth item. With a confused sense that he's about to learn something significant about himself, he turns on the sound and stands facing the tiny set, drying his hands on a towel. Placed fourth could mean no developments or sinister silence from the authorities. But in fact, the story has collapsed. You can almost hear in the introduction the presenter's regretful tone. There they are, the pilot, the wizened fellow with a slicked back hair and his tubby co-pilot standing outside a hotel near Heathrow. They are not, the pilot explains through a translator, Chechens or Algerians. They are not Muslims. They are Christians, though only in name, for they never attend church and own neither a Quran nor a Bible. Above all, they are Russians, and proud of the fact. They are certainly not responsible for the American child pornography found half-destroyed in the burned-out cargo. They work for a good company registered in Holland, and their only responsibilities are to the plane. And yes, of course, child pornography is an abomination, but it's not part of their duties to inspect every package listed on the manifest. They've been released without charge, and when the Civil Aviation Authority tells them it's appropriate, they'll return to Riga. Also dead is the controversy about the plane's route into the airport. The correct procedures were followed. Both men insist they've been treated with courtesy by the Metropolitan Police. The plump co-pilot says he wants a bath and a long drink. Good news. But as he walks out of the kitchen in the direction of the larder, Henry feels no particular pleasure, not even relief. Have his anxieties been making a fool of him? It's part of the new order, this narrowing of mental freedom, of his right to roam. Not so long ago, his thoughts ranged more unpredictably over a longer list of subjects. He suspects he's becoming a dupe, the willing, febrile consumer of news fodder, opinion, speculation, and of all the crumbs the authorities let fall. He's a docile citizen watching Leviathan grow stronger while he creeps under its shadow for protection. This Russian plane flew right into his insomnia, and he's been only too happy to let the story and every little nervous shift of the daily news process colour his emotional state. It's an illusion to believe himself active in the story. Does he think he's contributing something, watching news programmes or lying on his back on the sofa on Sunday afternoons reading more opinion columns of ungrounded certainties, more long articles about what really lies behind this or that development, or about what is most surely going to happen next, predictions forgotten as soon as they are read, well before events disprove them? For or against the war on terror, or the war in Iraq? For the termination of an odious tyrant and his crime family? For the ultimate weapons inspection? The opening of the torture prisons? Locating the mass graves, the chance of liberty and prosperity, and a warning to other despots? Or against the bombing of civilians, the inevitable refugees and famine, illegal international action, the wrath of Arab nations, and the swelling of Al-Qaeda's ranks? Either way, it amounts to a consensus of a kind, an orthodoxy of attention, a mild subjugation in itself. Does he think that his ambivalence, if that's what it really is, excuses him from the general conformity? He's deeper in than most. His nerves, like tautened strings, vibrate obediently with each news release. He's lost the habits of scepticism. He's becoming dim with contradictory opinion. He isn't thinking clearly, and just as bad, he senses he isn't thinking independently. The Russian pilots are shown walking into the hotel, and that's the last he'll ever see of them. He fetches a few bottles of tonic from the larder, checks on the ice cube maker and the gin, 3/4 of a litre is surely enough for one man, and turns off the heat under his stock. Upstairs on the ground floor, he draws the curtains in the L-shaped living room and turns on the lamps and lights the gas in the mock coal fires. These heavy curtains, closed by pulling on a cord weighted with a fat brass knob, have a way of cleanly eliminating the square and the wintry world beyond it. The tall-ceilinged room in creams and browns is silent, soothing. Its only bright colour is in the blues and rubies of the rugs, and an abstract slash of orange and yellow against green in a Howard Hodgkin on one of the chimney breasts. The three people in the world he, Henry Perrone, most loves, and who most love him, are about to come home. So what's wrong with him? Nothing. Nothing at all. He's fine. Everything is fine. He pauses at the foot of the stairs, wondering what it is he was intending to do next. He goes up to his study on the first floor and remains standing as he looks at his screen to remind himself of the week ahead. There are 4 names on Monday's list, 5 for Tuesday's. The old astronomer Viola will be first, at 8:30. Jay is right. She may not make it. All the names conjure a history he knows well from the past weeks or months. In each case, he knows exactly what he intends to do, and he feels pleasure in the prospect of the work. How different for the 9 individuals, some already on the wards, some at home, others travelling into London tomorrow or Monday, with their dread of the approaching moment, the anaesthetic oblivion, and their reasonable suspicion that when they come round they will never be quite the same. From downstairs he hears the front door lock turning, and by the sound of the door opening and closing, a style of entering a place with economy, and of easing the door shut behind her, he knows it's Daisy. What luck that she should arrive before her grandfather. As he hurries down the stairs towards her, she does a little jig of delight.
You're in!
As they embrace, he makes a low, sighing, growling noise, the way he used to greet her when she was 5. And it is the child's body he feels as he almost lifts her clear off the floor, the smoothness of muscle under the clothes, the springiness he can feel in her joints, the sexless kisses. Even her breath is like a child's. She doesn't smoke, she rarely drinks, and she's about to become a published poet. His own breath smells richly of red wine. What abstemious children he's fathered.
So, let me have a look at you.
6 months is the longest she's ever been away from her family. The Perrones, though permissive to a high degree, are also possessive parents. Holding her at arm's length, he hopes she doesn't notice the glistening in his eyes or the little struggle in his throat. His moment of pathos rises and falls in a single smooth wave and is gone. He's still only in rehearsal as an old fool, a mere beginner. Despite his fantasies, this is no child. She's an independent young woman gazing back at him with head cocked, so like her grandmother in that tilted look, lips smiling but unparted, her intelligence like warmth in her face. This is the pain pleasure of having newly adult children. They're innocent and ruthless in forgetting their sweet old dependence. But perhaps she's been reminding him. During their embrace, she half rubbed, half patted his back, a familiar maternal gesture of hers. Even when she was 5, she liked to mother him and admonish him whenever he worked too late or drank wine or failed to win the London Marathon. She was one of those finger-wagging, imperious little girls. Her daddy belonged to her. Now she rubs and pats other men. At least half a dozen in the past year, if My Saucy Bark and its 6 short songs are a guide. It's the bracing existence of these fellows that helps him control his single tear. She wears an unbuttoned, scuffed leather trench coat of dark green. A Russian fur hat dangles from her right hand. Beneath the coat, grey leather boots at knee height, a dark grey woollen skirt, a thick, loose sweater, and a grey and white silk scarf. The stab at Parisian chic doesn't extend to her luggage. Her old student backpack is on its side at her feet. He's still holding her by the shoulders, trying to place what's changed in 6 months. An unfamiliar scent, a little heavier perhaps, a little wiser around the eyes, the delicate face set a little more firmly. Most of her life is a mystery to him now. He sometimes wonders if Rosalind knows things about their daughter that he does not. Under his scrutiny, the pressure of her smile is growing until she laughs and says,
"Come on, Doctor! You can be straight with me. I've become an old hag."
"You're looking gorgeous. And way too grown up for my taste."
"I'm bound to regress while I'm here."
She points behind her at the sitting room and mouths, "Is Grandad here?"
"Not yet."
She wriggles clear of his hold, loops her arms around his shoulders and kisses him on the nose.
"I love you and I'm so happy to be back."
"I love you too."
Something else is different. She's no longer merely pretty. She's beautiful. And perhaps also, so her eyes tell him, a little preoccupied. She's in love and can't bear to be parted. He pushes the thought away. Whatever it is, she's likely to tell Rosalind first. For a few seconds they enter one of those mute, vacuous moments that follow an enthusiastic reunion. Too much to be said, and a gentle resettling needed. A resumption of ordinary business. Daisy is gazing about her as she takes off her coat. The movement releases more of her unfamiliar perfume. A gift from her lover. He'll have to try harder to rid himself of this gloomy fixation. She's bound to love a man other than himself. It would be easier for him if her poems weren't so wanton. It isn't only wild sex they celebrate, but restless novelty. The rooms and beds visited once and left at dawn. The walk home down wet Parisian streets, whose efficient cleansing by the city authorities is the occasion for various metaphors. The same fresh start purification was in her Newdigate laundrette poem. Perrone knows the old arguments about double standards, but don't some liberal-minded women now argue for the power and value of reticence? Is it only fatherly soft-headedness that makes him suspect that a girl who sleeps around too earnestly has an improved chance of ending up with a lower-grade male, an inadequate, a loser? Or is his own peculiarity in this field, his own lack of exploratory vigour, making for another problem of reference? My God, this place is even larger than I remember. She's peering up through the banisters at the chandelier hanging from the remote second-floor ceiling. Without thinking, he takes her coat, laughs, and hands it back. What am I doing? He says. You live here. You can hang it up yourself. She follows him down to the kitchen. When he turns to offer her a drink, she hugs him again, then strides away with a little stagey skip into the dining room and beyond into the conservatory. I love it here, she calls to him. Look at this tropical tree. I love this tree. What have I been thinking of staying away so long? Exactly my question. The tree has been there 9 years. He's never seen her in this mood. She's walking back towards him, arms outstretched as though on a tightrope, pretending to wobble. It's the sort of thing a character in an American soap might do when she wants important good news wrung from her. Next thing, she'd be turning pirouettes around him and humming show tunes. I feel pretty. He takes two glasses from a cupboard and a bottle of champagne from the fridge and twists the cork off. Here, he says. There's no reason to wait for the others. I love you, she says again, raising her glass. Welcome home, my darling. She drinks and he notices with some relief that it isn't deeply. Barely a sip. No change there. He's in watchful mode, trying to figure her out. She can't keep still. She wanders with her glass around the central island. Guess where I went on my way from the station, she says as she comes back towards him. Hyde Park. You knew! Daddy, why weren't you there? It was simply amazing. I don't know. Playing squash, visiting Granny, cooking the dinner. Lack of certainty. That sort of thing. But it's completely barbaric what they're about to do. Everyone knows that. It might be. So might doing nothing. I honestly don't know. Tell me how it was in the park. I know that if you'd been there, you wouldn't have any doubts. He says, wanting to be helpful. I watched them set off this morning, all very good-natured. She grimaces, as though in pain. She's home at last. They have their champagne, and she can't bear it that he doesn't see it her way. She puts a hand on his arm. Unlike her father's or brother's, it's a tiny hand with tapering fingers, each with a remnant of a childish dimple at the base. While she speaks, he's looking at her fingernails, gratified to see them in good condition, longish, smooth, clean, glazed, not painted. You can tell a lot from a person's nails. When life starts to unravel, they're among the first to go. He takes her hand and squeezes it. She's beseeching him. Her head is as crammed with this stuff as his own. The speech she gives is a collation of everything she heard in the park, of everything they've both heard and read 100 times. The worst-case guesses that become facts through repetition. The sweet raptures of pessimism. He hears again the UN's 500,000 Iraqi dead through famine and bombing, the 3 million refugees, the death of the UN, the collapse of the world order if America goes it alone. Baghdad entirely destroyed as it's taken street by street from the Republican Guard. Turks invading from the north, Iranians from the east, Israelis making excursions from the west. The whole region in flames, Saddam backed into a corner unleashing his chemical and biological weapons, if he has them. Because no one's really proved it convincingly, and nor have they shown the connection to Al-Qaeda. And when the Americans have invaded, they won't be interested in democracy. They won't spend any money on Iraq. They'll take the oil and build their military bases and run the place like a colony. While she speaks, he gazes at her with warmth and some surprise. They're about to have one of their set pieces, and so soon. She doesn't usually talk politics. It's not one of her subjects. Is this the source of her agitated happiness? The colour rises from her neck, and every extra reason she gives for not going to war gathers weight from the one before and lifts her towards her triumph. The dark outcomes she believes in are making her euphoric. She's slaying a dragon with every stroke. When she's done, she gives a little affectionate push on his forearm as though to shake him awake. Then she makes a face of mock sorrow. She longs for him to see what's true. Conscious of taking up a position, girding himself for combat, he says, "But this is all speculation about the future. Why should I feel any certainty about it? How about a short war, the UN doesn't fall apart, no famine, no refugees or invasions by neighbours, no flattened Baghdad, and fewer deaths than Saddam causes his own people in an average year? What if the Americans try to organise a democracy, pump in the billions and leave because the president wants to get himself re-elected next year? I think you'd still be against it, and you haven't told me why." She pulls away from him and faces him with a look of anxious surprise. "Daddy, you're not for the war, are you?" He shrugs. No rational person is for war. "But in 5 years we might not regret it. I'd love to see the end of Saddam. You're right, it could be a disaster. But it could be the end of a disaster and the beginning of something better. It's all about outcomes, and no one knows what they'll be. That's why I can't imagine marching in the streets." Her surprise has turned to distaste. He raises the bottle and offers to top up her glass, but she shakes her head and sets her champagne down and moves further away. She isn't drinking with the enemy. "You hate Saddam, but he's a creation of the Americans. They backed him and armed him." "Yes, and the French and Russians and British did too. A big mistake. The Iraqis were betrayed, especially in 1991 when they were encouraged to rise against the Ba'athists who cut them down. This could be a chance to put that right."
"So you're for the war?"
"Like I said, I'm not for any war. But this one could be the lesser evil. In 5 years we'll know."
"That's so typical."
He smiles uneasily. "Of what?"
"Of you."
This isn't quite the reunion he imagined, and as sometimes happens, their dispute is getting personal. He's not used to it. He's lost his touch. He feels a tightness above his heart. Or is it the bruise on his sternum? He's well into his second glass of champagne. She's hardly touched her first. Her dancing impulses have vanished. She leans by the doorway. Arms folded squarely, the little elfin face tight with anger. She responds to his raised eyebrows.
"You're saying let the war go ahead, and in 5 years if it works out, you're for it, and if it doesn't, you're not responsible?" You're an educated person living in what we like to call a mature democracy, and our government's taking us to war. If you think that's a good idea, fine, say so, make the argument, but don't hedge your bets. Are we sending the troops in or not? It's happening now, and making guesses about the future is what you do sometimes when you make a moral choice. It's called thinking through the consequences. I'm against this war because I think terrible things are going to happen. You seem to think good will come of it, but you won't stand by what you believe.
He considers and says, "It's true. I honestly think I could be wrong." This admission and his pliant manner make her angrier.
"Then why take the risk? Where's the cautionary principle you're always going on about? If you're sending hundreds of thousands of soldiers to the Middle East, you better know what you're doing. And these bullying, greedy fools in the White House don't know what they're doing. They've no idea where they're leading us. And I can't believe you're on their side."
Perrone wonders if they're really talking about something else. Her "so typical" still bothers him. Perhaps her months in Paris have given her time to discover fresh perspectives on her father, and she doesn't like them. He turns the thought away. It's good, it's healthy to have one of their old head-to-head arguments. It's family life resumed. And the world matters. He eases himself onto one of the high stools by the center island and gestures for her to do the same. She ignores him and remains by the door, arms still crossed, face still closed. It doesn't help that he becomes calmer as she grows more agitated, but that's his habit, professionally ingrained. "Look, Daisy, if it was down to me, those troops wouldn't be on the Iraq border. This is hardly the best time for the West to be going to war with an Arab nation, and no plan in sight for the Palestinians. But the war's going to happen, with or without the UN, whatever any government says or any mass demonstrations. The hidden weapons, whether they exist or not, they're irrelevant. The invasion's going to happen, and militarily it's bound to succeed. It'll be the end of Saddam and one of the most odious regimes ever known, and I'll be glad."
"So ordinary Iraqis get it from Saddam, and now they have to take it from American missiles, but it's all fine because you'll be glad?"
He doesn't recognize the rhetorical sourness, the harshness in her throat. He says, "Hang on," but she doesn't hear him.
"Do you think we're going to be any safer at the end of all this? We'll be hated right across the Arab world. All those bored young guys will be queuing up to become terrorists."
"Too late to worry about that," he says over her. 100,000 have already passed through the Afghan training camps. At least you must be happy that's come to an end." As he says this, he remembers that in fact she was, that she loathed the joyless Taliban, and he wonders why he's interrupting her, arguing with her, rather than eliciting her views and affectionately catching up with her. Why be adversarial? Because he himself is stoked up. There's poison in his blood, despite his soft tone. And fear and anger constricting his thoughts, making him long to have a row. Let's have this out. They are fighting over armies they will never see, about which they know almost nothing.
"There'll be more fighters," Daisy says. "And when the first explosion hits London, your pro-war views..."
"If you're describing my position as pro-war, then you have to accept that yours is effectively pro-Saddam."
"What fucking nonsense!"
As she swears, he feels a sudden surge in his being, driven partly by astonishment that their conversation is moving out of control, and also by a reckless, enlivening joy, a release from the brooding that has afflicted him all day. The colour has gone from Daisy's face, and the few freckles she has along her cheekbone are suddenly vivid in her share of the basement kitchen's pools of downlighting. Her face, which typically in conversations is at a quizzical angle, confronts him with a level glare of outrage. Despite his leap of feeling, He looks calm as he takes a drink of champagne and says, "What I meant is this. The price of removing Saddam is war. The price of no war is leaving him in place." It was meant as a conciliatory point, but Daisy doesn't hear it that way. "It's crude and ugly," she says, "when the war lobby calls us pro-Saddam." "Well, you're prepared to do the one thing he'd most like you to do, which is to leave him in power. But you'll only postpone the confrontation. He or his horrible sons are going to have to be dealt with one day. Even Clinton knew that." "You're saying we're invading Iraq because we haven't got a choice? I'm amazed at the crap you talk, Dad. You know very well these extremists, these neo-cons, have taken over America. Cheney, Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz. Iraq was always their pet project. 9/11 was their big chance to talk Bush round. Look at his foreign policy up until then. He was a know-nothing, stay-at-home mouse. But there's nothing linking Iraq to 9/11 or to Al-Qaeda generally, and no really scary evidence of WMD. Didn't you hear Blix yesterday? And doesn't it ever occur to you that in attacking Iraq we're doing the very thing the New York bombers wanted us to do? Lash out, make more enemies in Arab countries and radicalise Islam? Not only that, we're getting rid of their old enemy for them, the godless Stalinist tyrant.
And I suppose they wanted us to destroy their training camps and drive the Taliban out of Afghanistan and force bin Laden on the run and have their financial networks disrupted and hundreds of their key guys locked up.
She cuts in, and her voice is loud.
Stop twisting my words! No one's against going after Al-Qaeda. We're talking about Iraq. Why is it that the few people I've met who aren't against this crappy war are all over 40? What is it about getting old? Can't get close to death soon enough?
He feels a sudden sadness and a longing for the dispute to come to an end. He preferred it 10 minutes ago when she told him she loved him. She's yet to show him the proofs of My Saucy Bark and the artwork for the cover. But he can't stop himself.
"Death's all around," he agrees. "Ask Saddam's torturers at Abu Ghraib prison and the 20,000 inmates. And let me ask you a question. Why is it, among those 2 million idealists today, I didn't see one banner, one fist or voice raised against Saddam?"
"He's loathsome," she says. "It's a given."
"No, it's not. It's a forgotten. Why else are you all singing and dancing in the park? The genocide and torture, the mass graves, the security apparatus, the criminal totalitarian state. The iPod generation doesn't want to know. Let nothing come between them and their ecstasy clubbing and cheap flights and reality TV. But it will if we do nothing. You think you're all lovely and gentle and blameless, but the religious Nazis loathe you. What do you think the Bali bombing was about? The clubbers clubbed. Radical Islam hates your freedom." She mimes being taken aback.
"Dad, I'm sorry you're so sensitive about your age. But Bali was Al-Qaeda, not Saddam. Nothing you've said justifies invading Iraq."
This ends Disc 6.